Today on the 21st show, several states have banned gender-affirming care for trans youth, making Illinois something of a haven for people seeking this sort of care. And yet, it's still a difficult landscape for kids, teens, and their families to navigate. We'll talk about all of this with people getting gender-affirming care and with people who provide that care. Plus, we've been collecting your questions, comments, and concerns about this topic, and we'll address as many of those as we can. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. This has been a challenging year, to say the least, for kids and teenagers who are transgender, as well as their families. Hundreds of anti-LGBTQ legislation bills have been introduced across the country, many of them aimed specifically at trans people. Several of those bills have become law, though they are facing judicial scrutiny. For example, in Arkansas, just yesterday, a federal judge struck down that state's first-in-the-nation ban on gender-affirming care. Many of the states around Illinois have also enacted laws that not only prevent trans youth from signing up for care, but also take it away from people who are already getting it. Take Missouri, where earlier this month, the governor signed a law banning gender-affirming care for minors. Our colleagues at St. Louis Public Radio spoke with some children, younger children in particular, 9 to 11 years old, who will be affected by that. If not now, then down the line. Let's hear briefly from one of them. This is from the show St. Louis on the Air, back in March.
It just feels wrong to know that the government is taking these bills that people are proposing, like the bill sponsors don't even know what the bill is about. They're like, this bill will save women's sports, and then give no explanation how, no explanation why, and they'll like misdirect the conversation, and they'll try to like pretend that they don't know what these bills are. And it's just like, it's slightly annoying feeling to know that like there are lots and lots and lots of people here telling you that this bill is wrong, and yet you file it years and years and years over and over and over and over again.
Despite all this legislative activity and the opinions expressed every which way on these topics, only 11% of us know somebody who's trans. That's according to a recent survey from the nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute. Major medical associations have recognized the role and importance of gender-affirming care, but that care has still come under fire, and our conversations about it are filled with everything from good faith confusion to bad faith disinformation. And it's not just kids who are affected. Trans adults have even struggled to access care in some states. Next week, we'll be talking with trans adults and healthcare providers here in Illinois about what care for them can and does look like, as well as the difference that makes. But today, for our entire program, we're going to take a deep dive into gender-affirming care for trans youth, what it is and what it isn't. For that, we're joined first by Dr. Diane Alexander. She's a psychologist who practices in Champaign, Urbana, who's worked with trans youth, and she's a trans woman herself. Dr. Alexander, welcome to the 21st Show.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Also with us is Dr. Sue Jordan. She's director of the Gender Pathways Program with Northwestern Medicine in Chicago, and her focus includes trans healthcare and gender-affirming surgery, though, as we'll get into, surgery is not usually part of that care for trans youth. But for now, Dr. Jordan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Certainly, we'll be talking more about the medical side of this as we go on, but we also want to bring in the perspectives of young trans people and their families. Jaden Seaman Kessler is a trans man who lives in Champaign, Urbana. He came out late in his junior year of high school, graduated in 2021, and has been on testosterone since later that same year after he turned 18. Jaden, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Megan Hopper is the parent of Will, a trans man, 18 years old, who came out early in the COVID-19 pandemic. Megan's in Bloomington, and she joins us live. Megan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I should mention a couple of our producers, Christine Hatfield, Noah Henderson, spoke with Will and Megan late last week. We'll be listening to excerpts from their conversation throughout our conversation today. We'll also be joined later by an expert on trans healthcare and gender-affirming care bans. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number as ever, 800-222-9455. All right, Jaden, I want to start this off with you. As I mentioned just a moment ago, you came out as trans late in your, was it junior year of high school? Briefly tell us, when did you first realize something was off for you?
I think that a majority of my life I kind of knew something was off, but I didn't know exactly what it was. And I grew up in a family that we didn't talk about that, and I think that trans people in general wasn't a topic that we started talking about or, like known about in media and stuff like that until, like, the last, you don't know, like, 6 years. And, I mean, I remember being in eighth grade, and I remember kind of, like, hating myself, and it sounds very, that sounds very bad, but, like, I did, and I didn't know why. And I remember, like, I came out as a lesbian in my freshman or sophomore year of high school, and I thought that's what, you know, would have fixed it, and that's what I felt so bad about, but it wasn't the case, and I felt even worse afterwards. And I think about my junior year, I had a friend that kind of knew how I felt, and she was able to say it because I couldn't put it into words because I didn't want to accept that, just because I knew... I knew how kids got treated in school, and I knew how adults treated other kids who were trans, and I think that I knew that my life wasn't going to go the way I wanted it to go exactly, but I'm glad that it went this way. I'm more happy than I ever thought I would be, but I think then I kind of knew, I realized.
What did it take for you to get to that point of being able to, I guess, accept it within yourself and talk about it, you know, coming out publicly?
I think that I had to do a lot of, like, self... I had a very, very long... Well, I shouldn't say very long. It's only been 2 years. But I had a very thorough journey of discovery about myself. I had to realize what made me me and, like, what served me the most. And I think that what made me the happiest, and I had to learn about not taking, you know, a lot of bullying from other people. I mean, not just kids, but adults. And I had to learn a lot about myself, and I think that over that time, I really learned that being trans isn't my whole personality. I mean, it's a very big part of me, and I'm very proud to be trans, but I think that's just always who I've been.
Megan Hopper, I want to bring you into the conversation now. I mentioned that interview with our producers last week. Let's listen to a little bit of Will's thoughts on figuring out his gender.
I started noticing more around middle school. It was through like sixth through eighth grade that it was really uncomfortable. And I didn't really know what it was. I've never really heard about like LGBTQ stuff or like transgender specifically. So I didn't know any terminology or anything for that. But in freshman year, I was pretty sure that I was a guy. It was just like... I don't know what this is still. It was really confusing. So I went by like a whole bunch of different names then, but.
At school.
Well, no one at home, but in the early years, like looking back in elementary school and stuff, there were tons of things that like not wearing to wear certain shirts and stuff or colors because I wanted to hang out with boys instead. And like, just like trying to see more masculine in dressing later, or it was just, I don't know, most confusing time of my life for sure.
So Megan, from your perspective as a parent, what was the experience of coming out like for Will?
He actually came out to his dad first. They were cooking dinner together. And it was, you know, during the very beginning of the pandemic. So I was off on a family Zoom call. And they were off cooking dinner in the kitchen, and he just came out to Tom and told him, you know, hey, I think I'm supposed to be a boy. Like, I just don't feel comfortable. And you know, as a family, you know, I found out later that evening, Tom sat me down and talked to me, and Will and I kind of had a struggled relationship before, not because, you know, any issues between us. We just couldn't find common ground together. And when he did come out, it brought us so close. Like, we are the best of friends now. And I am, you know, his biggest supporter, biggest cheerleader, helping him through, you know, everything that he has to go through now as a trans man. So it was a struggle. I, you know, as a mom, as a parent, you know, learning to navigate this new child that you are meeting and, you know, getting to know for the first time. But honestly, I'm very thankful for it. I'm thankful that he felt comfortable coming out to us. I'm thankful that, we do live in Illinois where he can be safe and protected and, get the care that he needs.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think, I mean, as a parent myself, I think a lot of us who hear stories like this try to imagine how we'd react if our child was going through this. And, you know, even for the most supportive parents, as you said, there's a certain adjustment that's required. What has this been like for you and your husband?
Absolutely. It's a definite adjustment. You know, we were very thankful that it happened during the pandemic, because we were, you know, locked down. We were in our homes and it was just our family. So it really gave our family time to adjust and time to adapt and time to get used to pronoun changes and name changes and everything. So it was, you know, it was nice having that, you know, comfort of home and not allowing anybody else into our bubble while while as a family we were processing it. But I mean, I did go through, you know, kind of that loss that I think a lot of parents feel when their child does come out. I did kind of mourn the loss of my daughter. But like I said, I gained this incredible child, an even better version of my child, when he did come out and felt comfortable being who he was meant to be in the first place. So, you know, I did see a therapist, highly recommend that. I went and talked to a therapist and, you know, kind of worked through some things that, that I was dealing with personally, but, and that really helped me kind of come to the other side of that grief process. And, that way I could be a better support person for Will.
Hmm. Dr. Sue Jordan, I want to bring you into the conversation now, Director of the Gender Pathways Program at Northwestern. We often talk about this in terms of this medicalization, right? Gender dysphoria. And I guess this is a good point to ask, what exactly is gender dysphoria?
Well, gender dysphoria is that distress, that unease that one feels when their internal and external sense of who they are don't match with respect to their gender.
And how does that manifest? I mean, I'm sure it's different for everybody, but what do you see out there? What are some of the ways that people respond to that feeling?
Oh my goodness, there's a huge spectrum of reactions to that sense of dysphoria and that incongruence between their internal and external selves. And everybody is different, as you said. Sometimes it can manifest as depression or anxiety symptoms. It can be a lot of confusion, and everybody deals with that stress in a different way. And sometimes you might not even notice. It could be, you know, overwhelmingly positive even in their behaviors, you know, from the outside. You're like, oh, that's an extreme behavior that may seem positive to the rest of us, but really that internal distress is present.
Dr. Diane Alexander, psychologist in Champaign-Urbana, I want to bring you in now. Let's say a parent and a child come in seeking your help, your guidance. They don't even know what gender dysphoria is or have the words to describe what they're feeling, but they're questioning. How do you respond? What do those sessions look like?
Well, most often it's just to initially provide information, you know, because like you said, a lot of, you know, parents or their children initially know something is going on, but don't specifically know what that is. So a lot of times it's just providing information and guidance so they have a real understanding of what is occurring with their child.
And just to be clear, parents mm-hmm. are by and large involved throughout this process, right?
Oh, yeah, because of course they would be because providing therapy for anyone under the age of 18 by law involves a parent or guardian to some extent.
And Megan, without going too deeply into the details, that was true for you?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
True for me, true for Will. You know, we both have great therapists still to this day that help both of us out. So, yeah.
All right. So we need to take a break in a minute or two here, but I just want to get in this idea of gender affirming care, especially at younger ages. It often starts with this idea of social transition. So Jaden, I understand you started socially transitioning your senior year. What did that look like for you?
I was very uncomfortable with who I was at the time. So it was very difficult for me to tell people that, like, oh, I prefer to go by this, these pronouns and stuff like that. But I was also in lockdown because of COVID, so I wasn't in school at all. So I really only communicated with my friends and my family. And I also worked pretty full time. But I know that when I socially transitioned at first, it was with my friends, and they were very accepting. And I kind of, you know, it was like my, you know, I kind of want to be referred to as this. And it was very weird to hear me be referred to as like he and him when it started. But like it felt right. Like it felt good. It felt fulfilling.
But it took a while to get used to it.
Oh, yeah. It took, I mean, just because I think that I knew I was trans for a while. I just didn't want to accept it. So I like forced myself to believe that I was born, you know, as a girl. And that like you know, that like these feelings that I have are just normal. Every kid goes through them. And that like, you know, at some point they'll like subside. But obviously that wasn't the case. I was very wrong.
Yeah. All right. We're going to continue this conversation in a few minutes. We need to take a break. We are talking about trans care, gender-affirming care, specifically as it relates to youth. We're going to continue when we come back. This is the 21st Show. Do stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And for our entire program today, we're talking about gender-affirming care for trans youth, what it is, what it isn't, especially as we see bans on this sort of care becoming law in multiple states. As I said earlier, not many people know somebody who's trans. A survey from the nonpartisan Public Religion Research Institute released earlier this month found only 11% of the Americans surveyed knew somebody who's transgender, but that doesn't really stop people from having opinions on the subject. There's also a survey from NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Marist that found a plurality of respondents, 45%, say access to gender-affirming care should be restricted only to people age 18 and older. A little less than a third say it should be available to all adults and those under 18 with parental consent. And then one in four respondents say it shouldn't be available to anyone, regardless of their age. We'll come back to why that might be the case, but for now we're talking with psychologist Dr. Diane Alexander, Dr. Sue Jordan, who's director of the Gender Pathways Program at Northwestern Medicine, Jaden Seaman-Kessler, who's a trans man in Champaign-Urbana who came out in high school, and Megan Hopper, parent of an 18-year-old trans man, Will, who came out during the COVID-19 pandemic. We have a bunch of texts and emails we've been collecting from listeners with some questions as we're going to be talking specifically about the medical side of this. But you can join us as well at 800-222-9455. I do want to stick with this idea of the social transition for a moment, though, before we talk about some of the medical aspects of this conversation. I want to bring Will back into this in that he had a conversation with our producers last week, talked about what changed for him after he started to socially transition.
Luckily, I haven't really had any social challenges because, I mean, I don't know why, but nobody says anything to me or does anything with me, so I'm lucky. But I think the hardest part was most recently, like for a year or so prior, it's just kind of coming down from the social transition. I just got pretty depressed and like I didn't feel very good about myself. Just, I feel kind of like, in the way, kind of, I take a lot of work to take care of right now. So I just felt kind of like a burden and wasn't really happy with myself, but much better now. But that would happen. Way better than before transitioning, but still, that was probably the biggest thing.
So Megan, as a parent, how did you see Will change in this social transition?
Oh, he was like a whole new child. I mean, once he came out and, you know, we took him shopping and we got him, you know, some new clothes that would fit his gender identity better. Even something as simple as tennis shoes, you know, make such a big difference for them. And so, you know, once we got all of those things, I feel like I say it all the time, I feel like we were meeting our child finally for the first time, and seeing who he was really meant to be. And it was really a beautiful transition. Even our friends, our family, that have known Will for his whole life, seeing how different he is now and how confident he is, how proud he is of himself. It's been a really awesome change to see.
So Dr. Jordan from Northwestern, let's talk about the medical side of this. At what point can medical transition start to be considered?
Well, there's definitely not an age or a number, because everybody is so different in their journey. But it starts with, you know, a social transition, finding a multidisciplinary team, a therapist to walk through any transition plans. And in terms of medications and surgeries, which I think is what you're asking about for medical transition, you know, that's a decision that comes from the parents, the patient, and the whole multidisciplinary team. The first step might be something like puberty blockers, which is kind of like a pause button. And that wouldn't start until the very early stages of puberty, where you can say, okay, let's hold for a second and continue on with our other care and support while we try to figure out, you know, what our goals are. I think that's probably where you would start.
How does that work, especially for younger teens? Would say more about the process, because I think there may be an idea out there that, you know, kid shows up on Monday and is put on puberty blockers on Wednesday or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely not. That is practically impossible, even if, you know, that was something that was desired. And it's not desired, right? I mean, it's something that it's a decision between first and foremost the patient, in conjunction with their parents and the mental health providers. So there's many models around the country. The models that I know of tend to be a multidisciplinary group of mental health providers, whether that's psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, or all of the above, in conjunction with pediatricians and adolescent medicine folks, endocrinologists if needed. And, you know, it's really quite a large team that gets together, listens to the patient's story and what their goals are. A lot of risk and benefit discussion to kind of come to a decision about what the right timing and strategy is.
Megan, from Will's experience, what has access to gender affirming care been like in Central Illinois?
We've been very fortunate. I mean, when Will first came out, we did make an appointment with his pediatrician because we were clueless. We didn't know what, how to help him medically. And our pediatrician was kind of, we actually see our nurse practitioner at the office, and she was, you know, very honest and upfront and said, I really don't know much about this. This is my first experience, but I'm willing to learn with you if you're willing to learn with me. And so we kind of learned the process together. She referred us to an endocrinologist to talk about puberty blockers. But at that point, Will was so far into puberty already, it really wasn't a good option for him. And so that was when we started kind of looking into starting him on testosterone instead. And Planned Parenthood was an incredible resource for us. They have an amazing gender-affirming care program. And they were really, I mean, they've really helped us kind of navigate through Will's care, and the steps that we need to take, to just make him feel like the human he is.
And briefly, Jaden, what about you? What was your experience like accessing care?
I was also very privileged to have access to it. I didn't have a lot of issues. I did when I started and I reached out, wanting to get that. I couldn't find anyone in town that was like open to take me, so I had to go to Bloomington, and that's currently where I do go. When I did come out and I started having, gender dysphoria, and I kind of realized that, I do remember talking to my pediatrician at the time, and she was also very, had no idea what to do. And I then recently had started seeing a therapist that helped me out. And I'm trying to think.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. You, you were just talking about seeing a therapist but we can move on. Because I do want to bring some listener actually feedback into this. And we're going to talk about some of the arguments that gender affirming care bans are predicated on. And we got a text from Molly in Champaign who said, quote, "Trans people are absolutely under attack by Republicans. I also want to be honest about the fact that these Republicans are not concerned over the safety of these treatments, but rather this is about creating a wedge issue in the culture war," end quote. And to help us make sense of what's happening in this realm of politics and law and government is Alethea Zamatakis, who is a postdoc fellow in LGBT health at Northwestern University. Alethea, welcome to the 21st show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's circle back to what we just heard from Molly in that text message. Broadly speaking, what are some of the driving forces, in your view, behind these anti-trans laws, these bans on gender-affirming care?
Yeah, part of what we see in the push across states around these laws is in part what was said in that message. Republicans have spent millions of dollars. In 2022 midterm elections, they spent over $50 million on ads attacking Democrats for supporting trans rights, really believing that this strategy would be one that could win over their base. And simultaneously, Democrats have used this as a way to say, vote for us and we will enact legislation protecting your rights, which they never actually carry through with at the federal level. But we also know that behind these attacks, there's a large amount of money from different foundations. The American Principles Project, which is a far right organization, as well as the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Family Research Council, the Liberty Council, all have really bankrolled anti-trans healthcare legislation across the country through multiple millions of dollars through political endorsements and lobbying. And so there really are two forces, this continued push to use this as a wedge issue to further divide people, as well as a large amount of money coming from Christian fundamentalist organizations.
I want to share another text message from a listener. This is Marianne in Champaign, who said, "I think this is a situation that is best handled by parents and doctors on behalf of trans youth. I've been a supportive family member of my sister and nephew that traversed this landscape beginning in his preteen years. Now in his mid-20s, he's in a pretty good place." We also heard from Anne in East Peoria who said, "For anyone with an opinion about gender-affirming care, I would like to ask if they want their own medical treatments decided by uninformed people they don't know." Dr. Alexander, what do you think about those comments?
Well, if I might, I'd like to quickly go back to the statement about social transition, just because that is such an important time for youth, because it's critical for them to experience the reality of, change, gender change, versus their thinking. And that really helps to bring individuals into line that have had that kind of questioning. And I find that that's kind of a point where some individuals may realize, is this what I really want? versus those who are able to say, yes, this is very affirming to me as an individual to actually be myself in society. Because at that point, that's where you start experiencing some of the repercussions from society as to your presentation. So I wanted to, you know, make sure that we explained that point.
Sure.
But as far as care, I agree with, you know, the listener. It's number one, you know, parents are the individuals that are best able to make those determinations in conjunction with therapists and with doctors. I mean, it's just an overreach, in my opinion, that the government would look to assume that role.
We had a
listener. Can I chime in on this as well?
Please. Mm-hmm. Sure.
As a parent, I couldn't agree more. Like when you read both of those text messages from the listeners, you know, I had myself muted and immediately I was like, yes, oh my gosh, yes. Like we don't choose this life for our child. We don't choose for their life to be forever hard. Being trans is not easy. It's not fun. There are mental struggles, doctor's appointments. And I would never choose this life for my child. But because this life is where he is meant to be, I'm going to love him through it. I'm going to work with him. I'm going to, and that's our job as parents, is to love and support our children unconditionally, and help them become the best version of themselves. And it blows my mind that so many people think that this is a choice and that parents are choosing to put their children through this. And we're not, we're just trying to love our children the best way that we know how and make sure that they have the happiest lives that they can have.
Couldn't agree more.
I want to share another email from a listener. This is someone from Central Illinois. Did not want to be named on air. But one of the things they said was, I implore listeners to exercise caution when considering irreversible medical treatments for minors who present with gender dysphoria, end quote. And we do often hear that word, irreversible. If someone is only socially transitioned, sure, easy enough to grow a different hairstyle or whatever. But if someone is only, if we're talking about puberty blockers, Dr. Jordan, to what extent is a transition irreversible?
Puberty blockers, again, kind of put a pause on a lot of the changes that happen during puberty. Once you come off puberty blockers, those changes are going to kick back in and continue on. When we're talking about hormone therapy, like testosterone for our trans men, that can cause some changes. It can cause things like hair growth and muscle mass to increase. It can cause some voice deepening. Mm-hmm. And some of those things will reverse when you come off of testosterone, and some of them will not. And the degree to which some of those things reverse will be different for everybody as well. And then, of course, as you move along the spectrum to things like surgery is real cuts and real surgery. And a lot of those changes are irreversible in the sense that, you know, you can't restore things to be completely the way they were before.
Sure. I'm glad you mentioned that. And we need to take a break in a minute. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I do want to be clear, though, because, I mean, when we're talking about kids, especially, you know, tweens, right? The people who are not preteens. I mean, we had listeners in our texting group asking about surgery and kids of that age. Does that happen?
There are some cases when adolescents are ready for surgery that it happens below 18, but it's not common. It certainly is not a rule. But we treat patients where they are, you know, at the time that they present, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not going to say, come back in 5 years when you've turned 18. We're not going to come back and say, you know, you should have been here yesterday. We treat the patients that are in front of us and what they need at the time. And, you know, if that is the right decision for them at that time, that chronological age is less important than the journey that they've already been through. But again, just to be clear, you know, surgery under 18 is unusual. It's not common. And certainly it's generally limited to what's known as top surgery or surgery on the chest.
Okay. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back. 800-222-9455. This is the 21st Show. Do stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been talking today about care for transgender youth, especially on bans on that care sweep across the country. With us to talk about how that looks in their lives is Jaden Seaman Kessler, a trans man in Champaign-Urbana who came out in high school, and Megan Hopper, parent of an 18-year-old trans man, Will, who came out during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're also speaking with experts, psychologist Dr. Diane Alexander, as well as Dr. Sue Jordan, who's director of the Gender Pathways Program at Northwestern Medicine, and Alethea Zamatakis, a postdoc fellow in LGBT health at Northwestern University. 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. And Dr. Alexander, I understand you wanted to respond to some of the things we were just talking about before we had to take a break about the idea of surgery for younger people.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. One of the things I'd like to point out is there are very stringent guidelines that are in place. Someone just can't just willy-nilly get surgery. There are time frames that have to be looked at. There's a number of therapeutical goals a person would have to meet. It's just not something that is done without, you know, it can be very prohibitive, actually, if their guidelines are followed before the person would even be considered for any type of surgery at all.
And so, Jaden, do you have a perspective on what we've been talking about?
Yeah, I so when I started getting care for all this, I actually am getting top surgery in about a week and a half from today, which is really exciting. But I mean, it took me over a year to get to this point. I mean, I had to go to doctors and evaluations and reach numbers and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's not easy. Nobody who isn't wanting this wouldn't go for it. You know, isn't needing this. This is a necessity.
You know, I want to bring up one other point. We heard something from a listener. Actually, it was the same listener who asked about this idea of irreversible treatments. Mentioned numerous European countries, France, Sweden, Finland, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom have reevaluated their policies for treating transgender children. Alethea, I mean, there have been some changes, and this point gets brought up not only by people opposed to gender-affirming care, but those of good faith who do wonder about it. What can you tell us about the policies of those countries?
Yeah, we have seen several European nations' medical establishments sort of turn against gender-affirming care as there has been a similar backlash against trans healthcare in Western European nations as there has been here in the U.S. The difference, though, I would say, is that doctors and the medical establishment within those nations are really being pushed by an even more rigid and an even more powerful set of politics that are really pushing to ban transgender healthcare and other rights for transgender people. The sort of anti-trans prejudice and discrimination, for example, that's even present in just the UK is much more intense and harsh than it is here in the US. It's much more common to hear people speaking negatively about trans people on everyday news in the UK than it is even here. And so thankfully, our medical establishment in the US, for the most part, has refused to give in to those pressures and instead has recognized, as was even recently argued in Arkansas, that, you know, doctors have a legal and ethical obligation to treat their patients, to treat the patient that is before them, as Dr. Jordan was saying, and to carry out that treatment, to not just end it because of a law that is being enacted for political and oppressive reasons.
I want to share another text from a listener, Dr. Jordan. This is from Sarah in Rockford, who said, I would like to see independent studies on trans youth that can justify or otherwise care for kids under 18 years old. I keep hearing anecdotal support for it, but how many youth are really being affected by delaying care until they are of legal age? They can't own a gun, vote, or make most legal decisions until 18. So why do we say they can forever alter their bodies when under 18? Dr. Jordan, how do you respond to that? Is what we know about this care really anecdotal?
No, it's not anecdotal. gender dysphoria, as we kind of started off the program, can cause all sorts of negative effects, including depression, anxiety, and you hear a lot about suicide. You know, a number of our trans youth have contemplated and even attempted suicide. And I hate to be crass, but that's truly irreversible. Just our adolescents are suffering, and to make them wait for an arbitrary age is not ethical. In terms of the evidence, you know, that we have had several years now of studies that have been conducted thoughtfully, looking at the effects of hormone therapy on our trans youth. And overwhelmingly, it has been shown that hormone therapy is beneficial and can improve the mental health of our adolescents. And there are, as well, you know, we ourselves conducted a study of top surgery in adolescents and young adults, and also demonstrated that reducing chest dysphoria, or that discomfort with the chest, reduces gender dysphoria, chest dysphoria, improves body image. And so we are not just looking at anecdotes, although they are very powerful when you see the patients coming in thriving after social transition and after medical transition. There are thoughtful studies being conducted that show a great benefit in treating the patients ethically.
Yeah, and I guess one more anecdote we can add into this is from Rana in Danville, who texted, "My 18-year-old grandson came out as transgender last year. They're now taking transitioning medications and are happier than I have ever seen them." Dr. Alexander.
Yeah, I'm looking at a recent study published by the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics that was done, I guess it was published in February 22. And as far as gender-affirming care for transgender and non-binary youth, the study looked at individuals 13 through 20. And simply what they found is that, you know, gender-affirming care, including puberty blockers or affirming gender-affirming hormones, was associated with a 60% lower odds of the person experiencing moderate or severe depression and a 73% lower odds of suicidality. That's very significant. That shows the power that gender-affirming care can have with the youth that need it. So in denying that, you know, you're looking at some really unfortunate outcomes as far as emotional behavioral health. You know, it's unfortunate, but transgender non-binary youth are kind of disproportionately burdened by poor mental health outcomes. And, you know, part of it is just owing to the decrease in social support and, you know, increased stigma and discrimination that society imposes upon them. The right is kind of using a similar playbook that they did toward gay rights in the 80s. You know, a lot of information that's totally untrue, unfounded, you know, not backed up by science, where, you know, people are looked at as being everything from pedophiles to, you know, being unable to understand or know what it is that they want. There's a lot of misinformation that's produced.
Only about 6 minutes left in our conversation. Megan, as we've talked about some of these states where care has been banned altogether, as a parent, how does it make you feel to see that happening?
Terrified. We've had those conversations with Will. I mean, he just graduated high school and, you know, he's off to college now and things like that. And, you know, luckily, thankfully, he's staying in state here and going to ISU. But those are things that, you know, we do have to talk about, what states he's safe in and what states he's not safe in. And that's tragic that an 18-year-old doesn't have the freedom to go explore the country the way that, you know, straight people do. It's sad, honestly, that there are so many trying to take rights away from something that they don't understand and they aren't willing to learn about it or learn to understand it. You know, you were talking before about the gender dysphoria, and like Will has been fully supported his whole time of coming out to us, has had nothing but full-on support from us as his family, but he still experienced that gender dysphoria, that deep, dark depression, because he did feel like a burden. He did feel like, you know, that he didn't belong here, and that it would be easier for the rest of us if he wasn't here. So even a child who's supported and loved and you know, brought through this, still goes through those emotions, those feelings. And we recently, Will is 3 weeks out post-op right now, for his TAP surgery and hysterectomy. And again, as a parent, I've gotten to see this incredible change in my child, where just clothes that he is happy to wear again, textures. You know, I made a post on my Facebook page the other day. We were leaving one of his surgical, you know, post-op appointments, and he didn't hold his seatbelt away from his chest for the first time in 4 years, you know, like things like that people don't think about. He would shower in the dark. He would, you know, hold his shirt out when the wind would blow. There's all these new things that he just gets to experience being a human being now, because he's finally comfortable in his body for once. So it terrifies me that he can't just go and explore the country the way the rest of us can. And it makes me sad for him, because I want him to see those things. But, you know, there are some states that we've said you're not allowed to go there until things change. So,
well, let's let Will have the last word on that. We have some tape from the conversation with our producers last week about the difference this care has made in his life. And this is what he said.
It just makes me feel more like myself and the person that I want to be and that I feel that I am or should be. But it makes it easier just to live life in general.
Makes it easier just to live life in general. Jaden, how about you? How is this care, being able to get this care and to be yourself, changed your life?
I have seen a drastic change in how I navigate my life now, and I am so much happier. I like also feel the same way that I'm able to live my life as who I am. There's you know, boundaries I'm gonna have to, you know, go around and whatnot, but I feel that I can live my life fully now. There's nothing there blocking that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jaden Seaman Kessler is a trans man in Champaign-Urbana, came out in high school. We've also been speaking with Megan Hopper, parent of Will, an 18-year-old trans man. I also want to thank Alethea Zimitakis, who's a postdoc fellow in LGBT health at Northwestern University, Dr. Diane Alexander, psychologist in Champaign-Urbana and a trans woman herself, and Dr. Sue Jordan, who is with Northwestern Medicine and is director of the Gender Pathways program there. Dr. Alexander, Dr. Jordan, Jaden, Megan, and Alethea, thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st Show. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
We love hearing what you think about what we have been talking about on the 21st Show, whether it's today or any topic in the recent past. If you like it, if you didn't like it, if you think we got something right or wrong, let us know. You can leave a voicemail anytime, day or night, at 217-300-2121. The number again is 217-300-2121. You can also email us or get in touch on social media. All the ways to contact us are on our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. And while you're there, you can also find links to subscribe to our podcast or share a segment with someone else. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Just search for The 21st Show. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our intern is Owen Henderson. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll be talking with the president of the Illinois Senate, Don Harmon, as well as the new Miss Illinois 2023, Jessica Tilton, who is also a biologist. That conversation is coming up again tomorrow on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.